people are much more comfortable with the US dollar than they are with Bitcoin. And that's just how it is, right? I mean, because in order to be comfortable with Bitcoin, you have to have like this whole, you know,
yeah, we spent 10 years
system of education. You got to learn, right? If you don't learn, you're buying Shiba Inu coin or something, right? You don't really like have to learn that much to understand the value of the US dollar as it exists today. And so what getting paid in a stable coin essentially means to these people is that they're getting paid in digital dollars anywhere in the world.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. This is a podcast all about people's personal journeys to Bitcoin. I wanted to know more about the people converging on this new form of money. Why do they see value in it? What skills enable their understanding? How is it changing their lives? If you're a founder looking for funding or an investor looking to make investments, then please reach out as I develop my network in the space. Do me a favor and chuck us a 5-star rating on whichever app you're using to listen, or a like if you're watching it somewhere. As insignificant as this may seem, they help a startup project like this hugely. Lastly, if you have any questions at all, please just reach out. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter at Jake E.S. Woodhouse. Now, I'd like to take a quick moment to talk about our sponsor. Fast Bitcoins are a Bitcoin exchange who you should definitely take a look at next time you're thinking of making a Bitcoin purchase. They're a great team, which for me is always the key to due diligence, whilst their product has a ton of features useful to every Bitcoiner. Check out my episodes with Danny Brewster, the founder CEO, and Nathan Smith, the chief compliance officer, to learn more about the people behind the brand. Thank you to Fast Bitcoins for sponsoring the show. Now, on to today's episode. Today, I'm speaking with Jonathan Chester. Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Hey, Jake. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I'm very excited to hear about your story and your view of Bitcoin. So we'll get right into it. I generally start at the same place, which is once upon a time, you heard about this thing called Bitcoin. Maybe your friend told you, or you were down the pub having a beer and you're like, that makes no sense at all. And then here we are today and, you know, you're building a Bitcoin-based business multiple years later. So teach me a bit about the first time you came across it and what you'd been up to at the time and why it was interesting to you, or perhaps uninteresting, at least from the initial phase.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first time, well, so there were two times, right? First time was the time that maybe I tangentially heard about it and didn't think that much about it. And then the second time was when I was working at Oracle. So right out of college, I start working at Oracle, and I'm working in their sales group, specifically their open source support sales. So I was basically trying to convince people to leverage their Linux kernel and their virtualization technology. I mean, you're part of this company. I mean, this is a huge company. It's a 120,000 person company. Wow. And when you're part of a machine like that, you know, it's hard not to feel like a cog, right? So I'm sitting there feeling like a cog in the machine, and I found myself, if I'm going to be doing this, I need to make sure that I'm learning every single day, right? There was just not enough learning growth in the job, so I decided to figure it out outside of the job. And, you know, before that, I had a background in economics, so I had that understanding behind me. But every single day, I would go and learn something new. And one of these days, I came across a TED Talk about the future of money. And it talked about several different things, such as how people would use Tide laundry detergent as money inside jail, or how Nike had shoes that would, you know, give you points as you ran and you could spend it on something. But it also talked about Bitcoin. This is 2013. And it talked about financial freedom, efficiencies in moving money across borders, and banking the unbanked. And I just became obsessed. After that, it really piqued my interest. And so I took about a month or two going down the rabbit hole, learning everything I could, you know, like reading the white paper, understanding nothing except the first 1.5 pages, and trying to watch things. At the time, like the best commentary you could find was Andreas Antonopoulos. And this was before he was big. So, like, you know, it would just be a video of him like at a bar talking to a guy about Bitcoin. And that really helped me learn and eventually get to the point, you know, years later, where I could understand the entire Bitcoin white paper, right? But yeah.
So I love the idea of being in a job that you're, you know, you're just spinning wheels, and you're like, okay, this is something I've got to continue to do because probably, you know, you've got to get paid or whatever, but maybe I can test myself outside of that. And that's just the natural curiosity of people. It takes them in different directions. Who knows where you might end up? In this particular case, you know, it was Bitcoin and money that caught your attention. So I'm intrigued as to perhaps why that was the case. So you mentioned economics. In my experience anyway, my entire framing of economics, having learned more about Bitcoin, is I didn't actually know anything about economics, but I'd be intrigued to hear what your background of economics was and why that was an important lens for when you came across the conversation of future of money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you still got to understand that I was like 23 at the time. I mean, I was pretty young. Yeah. So a background in economics basically means I got a degree at a university in economics.
Yeah.
So I'd spent, you know, the better part of 4 years learning about micro macroeconomics and how supply and demand, you know, affect prices and how monopolies and oligopolies, you know, interact with each other and the ways that they can sort of, you know, affect supply and demand to change prices and vice versa. So when I came across Bitcoin, it was easy for me to understand like concepts around, you know, having a maximum circulating supply and the reducing rate of inflation over time. I still needed to learn a little bit more. I think one of the best videos for me early on was a video by a guy named Wences Cesar, who was the founder of Zappo and was a brilliant Argentinian entrepreneur. And he basically broke down the concept of what money is. Because I think that you can't really truly appreciate Bitcoin until you break down like what is money, right? What is this concept of money? And he broke it down very, very well at the time. I think that now the Bitcoin standard does a very similar thing, but I don't believe that was out back then.
No, it wasn't. I think Bitcoin standard is 2018 or 2019 that came out. Something like that.
Yeah. But you know, it talked about the concepts of like fungibility. The concept of, you know, how easy it is to recognizability, how easy it is to maintain, how easy it is to conduct commerce with. And so I think there were like seven different principles of what money is. And then he goes into saying, you know, money developed starting as a system to cover debt, right? The idea that we had a barter system wasn't a direct, you know, I give you this thing in exchange for that thing. Instead, it was, you know, I'm in part of the tribe and I'm providing for the tribe. And I have, you know, in my mind, a general concept of how much people owe me, their debt to me, because I've been providing so much meat. And then eventually, you know, I'll feel like someone will give me back. But it's, you know, very imprecise. Money came about as a way to make it so that I didn't have to remember my debt anymore. Right. That was the goal of money, you know, to no longer remember what each individual person owes to me. And then the question is, okay, what are the attributes that this thing needs to have? And ultimately it comes down to how easy is it to trade and whether or not it's scarce. All the attributes care about these things. And gold sort of came about as this thing that had all the universal properties you needed to have a good form of money, a good form of, you know, categorizing other people's debt to each other. It had scarcity, not perfect scarcity, and it generally was hard to destroy and easy to move around with and all sorts of different things. And then he brings out fiat money and then eventually Bitcoin. What he brings to the table and what he shows is that Bitcoin is superior to at least gold in all of these different areas of what makes a good money, and of course has, you know, a perfect degree of scarcity as a counter to fiat money. And that video, it really helped me, you know, truly, truly conceptualize what is money, what is Bitcoin, how is Bitcoin better than the other forms of money that we've had before us.
I love, Jonathan, how well you remember that video. Like, you've almost just kind of recited, arguably, probably exactly what you were taught from that process. I mean, it's so incredible, isn't it, how you can have these moments where you go, oh, that makes so much sense. And you almost remember them, like arguably perfectly. And it is such a good discussion. I found that, so we'll be very similar age. So I finished university in 2011. I did a business management degree. I was trained in how to make money, but not necessarily to ask the question, what is money? And it's only in the last kind of 2 or 3 years where that's flipped around. It's like, okay, well, hang on, what is money? So it's very interesting how one's journey is unique and you end up consuming different things at different times in terms of information and how that then, you know, alters someone's trajectory in terms of their decision making, what they go on to go and do. So brilliant explanation. Thank you for sharing that. And all the listeners out there will have learned from that process for sure. So you left university and you ended up going to work for Oracle straight out of uni, which is, you know, a huge technology company. You mentioned already 120,000 people or whatever. What were the kind of jobs that you were doing there as a sales guy for Oracle? And what was that teaching you as a role? And you obviously moved into starting your own business. So I'm assuming there was some kind of entrepreneurial trait within there somewhere that you thought, okay, I've got to do something about this, and some hustle picked you up. So yeah, teach me about what that process was like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I learned the entrepreneurial trait as a result of Oracle. Oracle did teach me about sales concepts. Like, there was a whole sales training that I went through for like 3 months. Mm-hmm. My whole plan there was like, okay, they've got this huge database of people who use their databases. You know, let's just reach out to them and see if they want the open source, you know, Linux kernel and virtualization technology that Oracle offers. And I learned all about dealing with internal politics, you know, internally at Oracle and externally with, like, you know, the different stakeholders that you had to communicate with and try and get a deal done. You know, wow. Do you go to the CEO? Do you go to the systems administrator? Do you go to, you know, someone in between?
Yeah, who's the gatekeeper?
Navigate that? Yeah, who's the gatekeeper? Who's your white knight? All this kind of stuff. You know, how to deal with objections and how to spin things. But that wasn't, you know, I like to think that I was entrepreneurial earlier on, you know what I mean? And in high school, I ran a club, you know, and I've always actually been doing a lot of stuff for this organization called the Foundation Fighting Blindness, which is a nonprofit that is funding research into retinal degenerative diseases, like macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa, Usher disease, things like this. Wow. And they've got, you know, they've raised about $1 billion to date. They deployed, you know, almost all that capital into that. But that's to say that when I was in high school, I created a club and ran my own team in sort of their version of a walkathon. And then in college, I actually chaired an entire walkathon, like the first one in Santa Barbara. And, you know, those are kind of like little bouts of, you know, my entrepreneurialness, I would say. And if I had not run into Bitcoin, the thing that I was trying to do is I was trying to create like a way to get yups, younger urban professionals more involved in charitable organizations. So I was working actually on that and trying to get like Oracle executives involved. I had some other people on my team and we were running some events. But then when I found about Bitcoin, it was like, okay, this is even more interesting than this. And I swung that way.
A lot of the type of people I meet who want to start companies have always tried to do things that other people told them they couldn't do, or willingly took risk when actually they didn't see it as a risk. And there's a number of different reasons why people make those decisions. So no, you're answering it brilliantly. And arguably a 120,000 employee company is actually not very entrepreneurial when it's got to that size. So it doesn't surprise me at all, actually, that, you know, you basically push back and explain that it was other areas that you've been doing that. But what piqued my interest is, so is blindness something that's close to your heart from a family perspective, perhaps? Or why did you end up looking at that specific issue?
Yeah. So as far back as I remember, I've kind of been volunteering because my mom has a retinal degenerative disease. It's a genetic one called retinitis pigmentosa. And what it basically does is it causes your retina to slowly decay, which means that you get tunnel vision. So when I'm sitting across the table from my mother and having a dinner with her, she can only see part of my face and nothing else around.
Wow.
Right? Wow. So it's always been like a pretty important part of my life. I mean, she got involved, you know, when I was very young. She was forced to actually resign from her work because of her condition when I was 7 years old, something like that. And so, you know, at those fundraisers, like selling tickets, you know, I still, you know, do a little bit of volunteer work for them today. They have a strategic council and I'm there and I'm part of their finance board as well. Oh. But, you know, life's busy. So I try to do what I can there.
No, an amazing work. Like, keep it up. Really cool story to hear. What then intrigues me is this whole idea of, okay, social impact work is very, very important. And not just because of money per se or value generation, but, well, actually it's probably the wrong way of saying it. Helping your mother is value generation. Like, you enjoy doing that. You think it's an important task. I can feel that coming through in the conversation we're having now. So in some ways it's more than generating like bottom line profits. It's about, you know, feeling like you're having an impact. And an area of business that I became involved in at one point is this idea of impact investing. You take a portfolio of investments and you screen them based on their, you know, supposedly positive impact on the world. And the United Nations have something called the Sustainable Development Goals, which is like 17 different targets that they're supposedly working towards. And you can kind of filter your capital allocation based on these different targets into different equities, different bonds, different types of products. I was intrigued by that because I love the idea of your money working harder for you and for people than what a traditionally managed stock portfolio could potentially do. But then I came across Bitcoin and I realized that actually this was by far the most important tool for social impact that had been invented in my lifetime and would ever be the case. So from explaining the story you touched on with, you know, trying to help the yuppies get involved in charity, and then also the work you were doing with your mum, is that a similar realization you came to with Bitcoin? And why is that the case from your perspective, if that's true?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I still feel the need to spend at least some of my hours helping with the Foundation Fighting Blindness. So it's not okay. Like I've done a 180. But what I saw with Bitcoin, it was a very different thing, right? It's talking about being part of a new technology that can enable freedom around the world and really helping that reach its vision, right? So for instance, at Bitwage, one of the things that drives me, we enable a service where people get paid directly into any wallet or any bank account of their choice. You don't like put your money on our system and then have to withdraw it. And what I want to see is that we enable, you know, all the payroll, all the systems in the world where people are getting their salary, to enable them to get paid into the currencies that they want. There are a multitude of reasons for doing it, but it's usually related to, like, you know, I can't trust the monetary policy of my local government and I need a way to hedge against that. The idea here is, without our service, you know, the expectation could be that each employer partners with a wallet, each payroll system partners with a wallet. And so as you as a worker are moving between different institutions, you end up actually having, you know, getting paid into like different wallets. Some of them don't let you withdraw, whether it's regulatory or for whatever reason. And so one of the things that actually drives me is to make sure that that's not the world that we live in. It's just sort of this fragmented world where you're getting paid, but you're not really getting paid in Bitcoin, right? And instead, enable a world where no matter where you work, no matter what country you're in, you're going to be able to get paid into whatever wallet you want, your non-custodial, you know, mobile wallet, your hardware wallet, your brain wallet, or your, you know, exchange, if that's what you really want. For me, this is a driving factor, part of my mission of enabling the industry to come into its right, enabling people to maintain this kind of concept of financial freedom that Bitcoin enables, and to make sure that that's, you know, ubiquitous, at least for when people are getting paid. So it's kind of the same, but it is a different...
They're different problems to be solving.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it's not solving blindness, to be frank, right? It's a very different angle. But what intrigues me is the willingness to get involved in that type of impact focused work. And that's translated into, you know, now your entrepreneurial pursuit. So thank you for bringing up Bitwage. We should 100% talk about that. So you're at Oracle. You had an idea, I guess, or you stumbled across a very specific use case, and maybe with a mate who, you know, are you the more technical side of the team or someone else is the more technical side of the team? And how did it all start? I love hearing the stories of how businesses get off the ground.
Yeah, so here I am, 2013, and price of Bitcoin is surging from $200 to $1,000, and around $700, I'm telling people, you gotta buy Bitcoin, you know, it's the future. And everyone just thinks I'm completely mad, right? But, you know, there's another guy who is working in a more technical role at Oracle who is also related to Bitcoin. He's actually mining Bitcoin. And we somehow get connected. And, you know, we say, okay, you know, we both believe that Bitcoin is the future. If Bitcoin's going to be money, it's going to touch all the different areas of finance. And we looked at what was currently being addressed, right? And you saw wallets, you saw exchanges. So, okay, you can buy a Bitcoin, you can hold it. You saw merchant processors. So, okay, you can spend it. But once the Bitcoin got to the merchants, they couldn't then get the money back into the hands of the workers the Bitcoin. And so it wasn't a full financial loop. And so the idea is like, okay, well, that part of the loop needs to be addressed so that Bitcoin can essentially exist inside its own financial ecosystem. So let's be the first ones to do this. And that's kind of how this came about. And we basically quit our jobs because, you know, we thought this is the greatest idea since sliced bread, right? We applied to several accelerators and we thought we were going to get into them, but to make them feel like we're serious, let's quit our jobs first. So we quit our jobs and like the first accelerator rejects us. The second accelerator also rejects us. So now there's only one left and we're, you know, freaking out that we just quit our comfy jobs at Oracle. And like, what have we done? But luckily they ended up accepting us, which was the plug and play accelerator that helped us get to where we are today, right? Because before that, the way that we were working is, so John, he was actually from Stanford and he was living with his girlfriend at the time who was getting an MBA there. And so I'd go over to his place in Stanford and we just find like empty rooms on Stanford and like be working in like these classrooms. And this was like our office, you know? Yeah. And then when Plug and Play gave us a place to go, it was a godsend, right? Because I wasn't paying myself anything. He wasn't paying himself anything. We got to have an office and they offered free lunch for like a year. That free lunch was key.
Jonathan, you mentioned Plug and Play Accelerator. That was the name of it, wasn't it? Okay.
Yeah.
So, I've been through some accelerators myself, so I understand what those environments are like. But Bitcoin is actually full of people that have never been through the startup world. So what's it like going into an accelerator? What is an accelerator and why was that important for you guys?
Okay, yeah. So the concept of an accelerator is you get surrounded by a bunch of people that are helping you grow your company. And there's basically two levels of people. One is a set of mentors who either are like investors or people who've built businesses before. And then the other is other people who are at similar levels as you guys, and you go as a cohort in a group with other startups. So you get to learn from each other. You're basically working next to like 5, 6, 7, 8 other startups. So you're always talking with each other, getting ideas with each other, working off of each other, learning about each other's problems. And then you have the mentors who are coming in and saying, you know, these are the things you should be doing. This is how you should be thinking about things. You know, this is how you want to sort of frame your mind when you're trying to do different things. Like raising money, right? You have no idea how to raise money or dealing with legal things or dealing with regulatory things. They provide, you know, a lot of resources on how you should be thinking about this. All accelerators are always introducing you to VCs for you to raise, but with Plug and Play, they also have a program where they partner with large corporate entities. And so one thing that was really educational is that every week we would go in and they would have the large corporate entities come in. And what I didn't know is that these entities, they all have innovation groups.
Yeah.
So these groups are just
Oracle, for example, will have one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a small group of people in the organization whose job it is to learn about like startups and see if they have ideas that can either partner with the organization that they can become a client of, that they can purchase, or, you know, at the end of the day, or copy. You get to go in and they actually, these guys would give the presentations and you'd learn about like what it is that these organizations are looking for. And I actually still have some relationships, you know, I don't know how many years later, it's like 7 years later that I made during that time.
Well, and as a business innovating in the payroll space, like every large company globally has to pay its employees. So I'm thinking, you know, my mind's going ding, 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 ding. How cool. But, you know, those are potentially friendships that can help you introduce your product into, you know, big scale companies, which is a really key part. And I'm sure the phase you're at now. But before we get that far along the line, one thing that wasn't obvious there that seems obvious to you and I go through an accelerator. So did Plug and Play take a stake in the business on the way through? And did they pay you to be there? So there was some kind of equity transaction at the time, right? So you had to give away part of your business to attend the accelerator, correct?
Yeah. So basically they invest in your company and they take a stake as a result. Usually an accelerator will be a more costly investor than a typical investor because they are adding so many additional services on top of just money, right? I mean, an office, free lunch, access to VCs, you know, access to a whole bunch of things. So it costs more, but the thing is that they're paying you and they're taking equity, and that's a very high risk, you know, thing for them to do, because at the time we were two people with like a barely functioning product, right? So and an idea, right? It's a pretty high risk thing to be doing. So, you know, they're getting paid for sort of the risk that they're taking.
Yeah. And reasonably, you know, so it's a great business model. I love accelerators. I think they're such exciting places to be, and you meet all these people that are dreaming about what the future looks like, and inevitably it's risky. So they have to put money into, you know, 10, 20, 15 startups a year, however the business model might function. But yeah, cool. Really cool. So Jonathan, one thing I want to really highlight then is the use case that you had at the start. And then, you know, we're not far off 10 years later. How has that evolved over time? And so one of the things that's really important as startups is to be agile and to be able to pivot when you need to. So you've kind of already explained to us, but this idea that, you know, once a person who runs a corner shop or a big business and selling products online, whatever it might be, received their Bitcoin, they weren't able to then easily pay their employees in it. So there wasn't this kind of golden loop that was able to, you know, create a circular economy of Bitcoin through, you know, product, business, employee back into the marketplace. That was the initial pain point, right? And if not, correct me. And equally, like, where is that taking you to today? And what were some of the biggest changes along the last X many years?
Yeah. So our first product was enabling companies to pay their employees part of their salaries in Bitcoin. And, you know, if you imagine 2014, let's see, we had a big crash from $1,000 to like $300. We had the Silk Road and Mt. Gox. So it was just really, wow. You know, a terrible time to be in Bitcoin, and even more terrible trying to convince companies that they should allow their employees to get part of their salary. So as you can imagine, there was not a lot of adoption, but, you know, we were trolling the Reddit forums. And
those sales techniques, Oracle really coming into good use early doors.
And all these different forums, and we could see that people want to get paid in Bitcoin. And so we said, okay, well, why don't we turn it on its head and allow people to get part of their salary in Bitcoin, regardless of their employer signing up. We did that. And that's actually now, like, it's popular now. I think like Coinbase and Strike and Square and all of them have like basically copied our original version of this product. But we were the first ones to actually launch this. And I think it was the end of 2014 when that went live. And that started to get traction. We got a bunch of people to sign up and start using us. And that was really great to see that happen. I mean, I still remember actually the first time that we had like a transaction go through our system, you know, because until that happened, it's like, is this a real business? Right. And I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I was having a beer with one of my buddies. I think we had like gone up to Napa for some reason. And I found out that, like, you know, a transaction had been pushed through the system. I was like, oh my God, amazing. It's a real business.
Get another beer.
More beer. But yeah, so that started happening. And in 2015, we started noticing that there were kind of like two kinds of customers. There were ones who were getting a percentage of their salary in Bitcoin, and there were ones who were getting their entire salary in Bitcoin. And we looked into that, and it's like, okay, why are these people getting their entire salary in Bitcoin? And basically almost all of them were international. Wow. So what we found out is that people were using Bitcoin as a way to move money across borders to save time and money on those transactions. So we're like, oh, okay. Yeah, well, let's capitalize on this.
Yeah.
Let's capitalize on this, and let's do, you know, cross-border salary payments where we're using Bitcoin underneath the hood to, you know, go from one fiat currency to another fiat currency deposit at your bank account. So then we did that. And so our B2C product for getting Bitcoin or international fiat into your account were kind of what brought us, you know, all of our growth until about 2018. 2018, things kind of started to slow down and stalled. So I just jumped a bunch of years, right? We went from 2015 to 2018.
Go for it. It's all good. Fly through it.
Yeah. And you know, at some point in the middle there, we did like a pre-seed round. We raised like $750,000. So it took like a year and a half for us to raise any money. So I was literally like, you know, living off of savings for a year and a half. Got there, raised the money, and that $750K basically lasts us from the end of 2015 until 2020, or 2021. So we were really lean, and that those two business lines really brought us to eventually to 2018, and things kind of stalled after that bull market that happened then.
Yeah.
We were able to hit profitability, which was great, but things just weren't going. Now we hit 2020, COVID messes everything up. All of a sudden, everyone's working remote. Everyone's buying cryptocurrency because everyone's got more cash because the government's printing money and they're putting it into different assets, including Bitcoin. And we have this whole great resignation thing happening where companies were having trouble hiring and retaining employees. And so these things all together created this effect where all of a sudden companies are interested in Bitcoin, in stablecoin, wow, payroll services. And we just started to blow up. We've been growing 100% year over year since then. And until then, it was mostly our B2C product. But in 2020, companies started onboarding now too. So now it's about 50-50. Half of our business is the B2B product, half of our business is the B2C product. And, you know, we saw during the bull market a lot of growth on the domestic side. Now, sort of during this bear market, it's a lot more on the international side. But that's where we are today. And luckily, we're still growing because we're non-custodial and we don't, you know, offer, you know, all sorts of these high risk bells and whistles. Yeah. You know, we're not affected by FTX or Celsius or Voyager or Luna or any of this stuff. None of our customers are affected by any of this stuff either. Right. So despite all the chaos, we're still doing pretty strong today.
Brilliant. And so, Jonathan, if you were to take a snapshot today, this is a Bitcoin focused podcast, but I'm also not someone that, you know, you can invest in what you want. You can buy what you want. You can own what you want. That's totally and utterly up to you. I believe Bitcoin's the best thing to own a large proportion of in any portfolio you're running, but there's other opportunities elsewhere that will outpace it. And so as long as you're thinking of wealth accrual in terms of the Bitcoin hurdle rate, then fair enough. You know, shilling fraudulent scams is obviously something that's, you know, not great, and we should try and avoid that if possible, but sometimes people don't know, or, you know, whatever the case might be there. But of all of your customers today, do you have any numbers you can reveal in terms of how many people choose to get paid in Bitcoin versus a stable coin? And I'm just intrigued as to how the volatility on the short term for Bitcoin is very high. So receiving payments for something like your salary does actually have some more inherent risk, and therefore having it pegged to a fiat currency like a USDT or something, I can understand the use case for that completely. So how does that kind of interaction function? What do people actually choose to do? Because I genuinely believe, like, look at what they do with their money rather than what they say, to understand what's working and what's not. That makes sense.
I might go a bit deeper.
Go for it. Yeah, please.
I want to talk about, you know, why people are doing these things, and you know, how I think it basically all ends up leading to Bitcoin. During the bull market, we see a lot more growth on the Bitcoin side, and during the bear market, we're seeing more growth on the stablecoin side. We're not seeing people reduce their Bitcoin, actually, because, you know, all the people who've committed to get part of their salary in Bitcoin, they haven't lost that much money because of the DCA, and yeah, now it's kind of like a discount time for them, right? So they continue to use it. It's just that there aren't a whole lot of new people that are as gung-ho about getting Bitcoin, but there's a lot of people who are getting paid in stablecoins. And the reason for this is because if you think about, you know, the world, people are much more comfortable with the US dollar than they are with Bitcoin. And that's just how it is, right? I mean, because in order to be comfortable with Bitcoin, you have to have like this whole, you know,
yeah, we spent 10 years
system of education. You got to learn, right? If you don't learn, you're buying Shiba Inu coin or something, right? You don't really like have to learn that much to understand the value of the US dollar as it exists today. And so what getting paid in a stable coin essentially means to these people is that they're getting paid in digital dollars anywhere in the world, right? And they're doing it with less friction than they would through the traditional banking system. And that's why during the bear market, we're seeing more growth on that side of the business. But here's the thing. When you think about Bitcoin and the barriers to entry to Bitcoin, there are two real barriers to entry. One is volatility, right? A lot of people are like, oh, it's so volatile, don't want to deal with it. The other is public-private key cryptography. Like, oh, how do I handle this money? Like, what is this cryptography thing involved, right? And, you know, a lot of people really focus on making it so you don't have to think about public-private key cryptography, but you get exposure to the volatility, right? People talking about ETFs all the time. You know, everyone's trying to make, like, you know, these, like, really awesome custodial services. People are talking about how everyone's going to be using custodial services and, you know, you should just use them and get access to the volatility of Bitcoin. The amazing thing about stablecoins is that people are actually learning about public-private key cryptography to get access to digital dollar. And so you're actually breaking down what I think is a more important barrier to entry. Because at the end of the day, what matters about Bitcoin is that you have the ability to be your own bank, to be self-sovereign. So if you start learning, you know, about public-private key cryptography, even if you don't necessarily know the words themselves, through stablecoins, what ends up happening in my mind is, you know, the dollar brings itself down, Bitcoin rises as a global savings technology in its place, And now that you know public private key cryptography, it's just a button click to go from stablecoin to Bitcoin. Yeah. Nice. Right. And so I think that that's kind of just, you know, that's just a set of events that are going to occur. Whereas if you go the other way around, all of a sudden, you know, all of our Bitcoin is held on Binance and Coinbase, and the governments are putting guns to Brian Armstrong and CZ's head and saying, hey, don't let anyone, you know, move more than $500 out of the account every month. And now these guys just own all the Bitcoin and you got to live with it. So, you know, I mean, I think that this path is actually a path that brings us to a world where, again, you know, I'm all about enabling people to have their money where they want it, when they want it, in a way where they can, you know, experience financial freedom should they want to. And this is how I see that coming to be.
Mm. It brings to mind that phrase of give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach a man to fish and you feed him for life. And it's just this kind of bizarre thing where it's incredibly important to self-custody your digital assets. And specifically Bitcoin, that's what it's designed for, right? To be your own bank. But people don't get that straight away. But it's only through getting burnt, having, you know, it's very convenient for Alex Mashinsky to say, look, guys, you're not going to ever work out how to do self-custody. Let me take control. All you've got to do is trust me with your digital assets. Well, people sign up because they love the sales pitch and they love the fact they can get paid without having to sell any digital asset. But look what happened. It blew up. Because they were having to take extraordinary risks on the back end to actually try and supply the product that they designed to sell. It didn't work. And there goes your digital assets. And people have got burned. And they've realized that actually they can store them themselves. And I think you're right. It's a really interesting angle. How cool. I hadn't thought about that before. So the demand for stable coins is actually trickling through to actually demand for self-custody. And once you've figured out self-custody, then the barrier to entry to Bitcoin is just not as big at all. Awesome. That's really cool. How many people are getting paid in Bitcoin versus stablecoins with Bitwage?
I can say that in the United States, it's overwhelmingly Bitcoin.
Is it? Interesting.
If you're in the United States and using your service, the likelihood is that you're either getting Bitcoin or US dollars deposited to your bank. If you're international, it's a much smaller percentage. When you're talking about abroad, people are using stablecoins like fiat currency. So if you think about, okay, I'm getting my salary, I having some portion of it in fiat currency and some portion of it in Bitcoin. So you're talking like what? Someone might not get any Bitcoin, so might get 30% of their salary in Bitcoin, so might get 15% of their salary in Bitcoin, okay. Right? But they're absolutely not getting 100% of their salary in Bitcoin, but they are getting the majority of it in stablecoin.
Okay, cool. And it's awesome to meet someone that's quite obviously solving a problem that needs to be solved. This is one of the crazy things as entrepreneurs in the Bitcoin space is that it's a completely new industry. And I don't believe it's a case of rebuild everything that existed in fiat on Bitcoin, because actually a bunch of services that are required in an inflationary system aren't needed when you work in a deflationary system. But where do you see things going in the future? And what excites you most about some of the feedback you're getting from your customers? And what's happening for Bitwage in the next couple of years?
So I think I almost thought you were going to ask about what excites me about Bitcoin. So I'm just going to answer that first.
And that's a better question, actually. So let's go for that, because that's what this is about people's journeys in Bitcoin. And you happen to be building a Bitcoin business, but Bitcoin is, you know, the central part. So please, what excites you about Bitcoin the next couple of years?
I'm excited for Bitcoin to eventually mature. And in my mind, Bitcoin is no longer early when it's no longer volatile. Right. Okay. Bitcoin is designed to be this boring asset, right? That really is mostly stable and absorbing average global inflation, maybe with, you know, increasing a little bit in value. Right. And why am I excited for that moment? And I don't know what price that's going to be. Is it going to be, you know, when Bitcoin market cap is half of gold, all of gold is the US bond market. Right. But the interesting thing about when it gets there is it's going to be the most liquid deflationary asset on the planet, right? It's going to be the only deflationary asset where you can actually have your money on the system and you're essentially risklessly appreciating against, you know, what other currencies are devaluing because of inflation. So you can risklessly have your money in a place where you're getting, you know, returns instead of losing it, and you can spend it as easily as, you know, you can spend pretty much anything, right? I mean, it's so liquid because it has centralized secondary layers and decentralized secondary layers and semi-centralized, right? You got the centralized ones of like Venmo and PayPal and debit cards and credit cards and all this stuff, right? So everything you can do in the centralized in normal finance payments world, you could do it with Bitcoin. But on top of that, you have decentralized, right? You got Lightning Network, you got Liquid Network, right? And so you're going to be able to do more and have more liquidity than you actually have with dollars today. So it's going to be so easy to spend in whatever way you want to spend, and you're going to be actually able to save money instead of losing it. And this is, you know, one of the things that I'm very, very excited for in Bitcoin. And, you know, how BitWage helps that process. I mean, my goal, as I sort of said before, is we want to enable all of like the different payroll and HR and contractor marketplaces to be able to do direct deposit of Bitcoin and stable coins for everyone in the world and into any wallet that they want on payday, right? So we want to make sure that we're enabling this part of the circuit so that people are able to get paid how they want, where they want, and when they want, you know, as they need it.
And so is that, like, do you see a lot of competition in the space for that particular type of product? I can see the use case, absolutely. And, you know, for example, I was using recently Airtasker, and the idea of like how many people are using that platform to do small tasks of like, you know, $15, $20, $100, and they're all over the world, and being able to be paid, you know, rather than offline, I'm having to pay a guy through my own Lightning wallet and whatever, and I'm playing around with TransferWise as well, and that didn't work, and, you know, all a bit hard basket. But that's the kind of use case you're imagining or you're explaining. So is there a lot of other companies having a go at this, and why are BitWage different?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there are certainly companies that either do all sorts of things and also are trying to do this. And then there are companies that maybe do one slice of what our business is as part of something bigger, right? Like there's a lot of wallets that have replicated our B2C product, right? There are businesses that go straight to the B2B product, but they're not like, you know, Bitcoin companies, they're more like we service DAOs and have 150 different coins, right? You know, the kind of stuff that's going to scare an average everyday company that's out there, whereas we're much more conservative on our coin offerings. And as a result, can have these conversations with these organizations saying, hey, you can get access to these benefits, you know, by maybe people get paid in Bitcoin and stable coins, but you don't have to take the risk of like, you know, accidentally introducing your workers to the next Luna, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and we,
so
you know,
painful,
and,
wouldn't it? Yeah. Fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. It would just be terrible. And so I think that there are competitors out there, and there are actually more and more that are coming out every day, but we've been around the longest. We're already on the V2 of our platform. So we've figured out the use cases. We've rebuilt it from scratch. We've made sure the things that organizations need and want are what's focused on. Whereas the competitors, they're all on the V1 of the system, or they, you know, they have to focus on other things, or they're an exchange, you know, and so they don't completely focus on this. I've talked to companies that are literally scared that, you know, an exchange product will trade against the employee payday, right? You know, do some FTX style stuff. And we're not an exchange. We're not a wallet. We're not going to be able to do that stuff. We're not going to be able to promote, you know, gambling of shit coins to your employees, because we decided not to build those facilities so that you have a compliant, conservative offering that gives you all the benefits of the risk.
Awesome. And it's that incentive alignment that's so important. It's, you know, the closer you get to Bitcoin, the more that you really affiliate with this idea of don't trust, but verify. And being able to see that the companies that you're using are transparent and they're only using certain products and they're only willing to promote certain things because they've done due diligence on them is all part of that newfound philosophy. Rather than just hand over your digital assets, like, well, hang on, what are they doing? And I really like how that seeps through into how I generally kind of look at decisions in my day-to-day life. So Jonathan, we've got roughly time for another question, and then we'll wrap it up on hitting an hour. The process you've gone through, you know, stretching back to 2013 now, when you first started studying Bitcoin, you're building a company that by all accounts has gone gangbusters the last 2 years. It's a very, very personal journey. So could you share with us, you know, some moments that you remember as being like, oh my God, that's fucking hard? And equally on the flip side of that, you know, what have been some of the most exciting and exhilarating processes?
Yeah, I mean, there are multiple events, but two kinds of events that were always hard. So one of them is running out of money. So we almost didn't get into an accelerator, and then we almost ran out of money again in 2015 when we actually ended up raising money at the end there, right? So both of those two events were obviously very hard because you're looking at your savings account, you're not getting paid, and you're just worried that it's not going to be able to get to the next level. The other hard thing was, you know, banks only recently started being okay with all this stuff. I mean, they're still totally not okay with it, but there's like this subsection of banks that are okay with it, maybe in the next 3-4 years. So there was a lot of like moving between banks in our service. And that was always very hard when a bank would shut us down because, you know, a lot of people, the way that they had us set up is that we provided them with a bank account that they connected to their payroll service. And so that they literally just don't pay attention and they're just getting Bitcoin, you know, every pay period. And then all of a sudden we need to change banks. And now we got to tell all the users, hey, you've been doing nothing for like a year and now you kind of need to do something if you want to continue to use us. Right. And that was always just a crazy, you know, time because you have a deadline. You find out from the bank. They don't even like call you, like your account manager doesn't know. You just get a letter in the mail. The letter in the mail is like, you're going to lose your account in, you know, I don't know, like 2 months or something. I never get
it. It's lucky you opened the letter. Mail, right? I mean,
yeah. But the worst case was like, I think one time they're just like, you've got 2 weeks to deal with this. And that was crazy. But, you know, we've been able to get through those. And every single time we're doing better, we're getting stronger, right? And luckily, we haven't had to go through that since in 2020 when we secured very high quality banking relationships.
Well done.
Let's see. Let me think of the process. I mean, yeah, there's the story of like when the first transaction gets through, right? That was amazing. We had a team that was remote. So very early on, there was three people, me, my co-founder, and our compliance officer, actually. And I remember when we raised the money, we all got together and we had a toast. And we're like, yes, we can pay ourselves now. Yeah. And then, yeah, probably my most fond moments, because we're 100% remote, right? Like we never see each other. My fond moments actually are with the people in my organization when we all get together and, you know, we all get to, you know, drink and we're working together, but we're having fun. And I always, you know, remember those times very fondly.
Awesome. Well, that's a good spot to wrap it up on. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for spending an hour with me today and teach me about your story. And there's a lot we can all learn from someone like yourself who's actually building on top of Bitcoin. I think we need more entrepreneurs doing it. And we will see that happen over time, I'm sure. But thank you so much for your time today. Last question is, where can people reach out and get in touch if they want to do so?
Yeah, you can go to www.bitwage.com. For our website. My Twitter is at John Chess, and you can, you know, reach out through any of those means.
Sweet. And obviously, if you're looking to get paid in Bitcoin, then get on the website, have a look at Bitwage, and see if you can get your employer to sign up, or equally, if you can do so yourself. Thanks to you again, Jonathan.
Yeah, thank you, Jake.
Okay, friends, nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. As I said at the start, if you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best. Jake.